I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, Ermelinda Cortez, who is Communications Director for SONG, Southerners on New Ground. It has been known regionally and nationally for its organizing and training work across issues of race, class, gender, culture, and sexuality with both LGBTQ people and allies. We're going to be talking, of course, about what happened in Orlando and how what was once a safe haven for LGBTQ people, a bar where people could have a good time, feel safe, and in many instances in the past at these kinds of places, people could organize for a lot of different reasons. So what happens now? How afraid are people? And what is the history here? What is the future? We're this hour going to be talking about the number of hate crimes that the FBI has reported and how many were attributed to sexual orientation. Some say that hate crimes against the LGBTQ community are very much underreported. To find accurate statistics is extremely challenging. There was so much sadness. There is so much sadness today, too, but so many people who have been so severely discriminated against, and during a time where Gay Pride Month is now and the marriage equality decision by the Supreme Court came down about a year ago, and now this horrendous act of terror, how do people carry on from this? How do you erase the sadness? What questions need to be answered here? What is a safe haven for the LGBTQ community? Those are some of the questions this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Ermelinda. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Ermelinda Cortez, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, there has been so much grief, hasn't there? It's just people are so enormously sad and crying and grieving, and all this during a month when Gay Pride is being celebrated, the anniversary of the Supreme Court decision. It's just horrendous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think that it's been really difficult in community. You know, at our organization, we have our largest membership gathering of the year, every June. It kind of is a little bit of a start of Pride season for us. You know, in the South, Pride season happens a little later than elsewhere in the country. And, you know, we have 4,000 members plus across the entirety of the U.S. South. And this membership gathering, which we call Gaycation, is a time for us to come together to celebrate one another and to be in safe space with one another and to define for ourselves what safety and what it means to be free from fear together is. And we were at that gathering this week with our members, and Sunday was our last day, and so most of us woke up to this news. And it was really hard to end a week of thriving and surviving of, you know, LGBTQ liberation in that space that is just a place for joy and to celebrate one another. And to wake up to that news was really challenging. And I think that we had to figure out how do we hold that space, knowing that we're holding space every day for the violence that our communities face across the board.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that there has been, until what happened over the weekend, a freeing from fear? Has the LGBTQ community felt a little bit of freedom from that in recent years or not?
You know, I think it's really dependent on who you ask within the LGBTQ movement and within LGBTQ community at large. I think that across the board, that the massive culture change that has happened for LGBTQ people in the United States because of organizing and leadership that LGBTQ people have brought has tremendously shifted the conversation and the reality of the day-to-day lives of LGBTQ people. Mm-hmm. That being said, the win of marriage equality was a drop in the bucket. right? And for so many of us who are Black, who are people of color, who are immigrants, who are Muslim, right, and walking through the day-to-day life of carrying our gender and our sexuality into the world, you know, I think depending on what our identities are and how those identities overlap, mm-hmm. Has really affected whether or not people have been able to feel like they've been able to live free from fear, right? We know that a lot of our membership base experiences daily transphobia and homophobia everywhere from their interactions with police to being called out on the street, right? So I think that for the folks that we work with every day, it's, you know, we find moments of joy, and I think that's part of why this act of terror has been so hard for our communities, because it happened in a place where we, as LGBT people, have created sanctuary for ourselves to live free from fear. So I think that, you know, I think in our day-to-day lives, we find those moments with each other and build community and build safety in the ways that we know how, and the reality is that the violence that we're experiencing doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm. And there were so many intersections of big issues in this act of horrendous terror. You had so many of the young people who were killed, and they were so young, were Latin. It was a Latin club. So you've got that issue, which is so front and center in this election and in this country. You've got the Islamic State connection and homegrown terrorism, which is so big in this country. You've got the LGBTQ backlash, which is big in this country and just became a whole lot bigger. You've got assault weapons in this. They're all front and center. It's kind of overwhelming, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is in some ways. And I also think that this is the conversation that our communities have been having for decades in this country. For those of us who are walking out in the world with those intersecting identities, mm-hmm. is that it's actually not a surprise to us all of the responses that are coming in, right? People are talking about everything from gun control to homegrown terrorism, right? And what's happening with immigration, right? And I think for us as an organization, you know, we've been working in this region for over two decades. And I think one of the things that is eternally clear to us is that the cultural backlash that comes to our communities working to be free and working to be safe, it always comes with a cost, right? It always comes with backlash. And I think that for those of us who are carrying those conversations around how our race and ethnicity fit in with our gender and sexuality, and I think that this particular incident has really shed a little bit of a light, I think, onto the public at large, right? And sometimes we say we can't talk about the public at large, but when we look at the conversation that is unfolding before us, I think that some of the conversations that we have in community are actually being exposed in a new way with the current rhetoric, with the current political moment and environment throughout the U.S. in this election year, right, where so much is at stake with a massive demographic shift in the U.S. and I think also with the organizing wins that so many of our communities, from undocumented immigrants, you know, to LGBTQ folks and all the overlap, have actually accomplished within the last 50 years. And the response to that, right, means that, you know, these conversations are unfolding in the public in a way that we have had to deal with mm-hmm. over and over again.
Yeah. Sometimes you think, well, we've made so much wonderful progress and everybody agrees with this and we become more inclusive and opening and warm in this country. And then whammo, you realize that a lot of people have a lot of problems with who we are and who we're becoming, okay. Even more so who we're becoming. Tell me about the importance, because people who have not been to a gay bar know the history of gay bars, the importance of this pulse Latin club in terms of having a safe place, that particular designation has historically been a safe place for people to come, LGBTQ people to come to party and also to organize politically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think there's a long history of gay bars and lesbian bars, you know, across the country. And I think both, you know, we have to talk about it both in, I think, a rural and an urban context. And, like, what does gay bar, lesbian bar, you know, mean, depending on the geographic location, right? But I think that LGBT people have always tried to carve out spaces of sanctuary for ourselves to build community, to build power, to build culture, and to be places of joy, and to be places where it feels like we can check out of the daily reality of what of the violence that we're walking through, right? And, you know, I think that over the course of time, gay bars have also been sites of violence and sites of resistance, right? I feel like that is how we often think about it. And, you know, I think often, like, particularly this club in Orlando, I think it's such a prime example of what we see in the South, you know, across the board, is that Orlando and other places like it, like Atlanta, like large cities in the South, become what we call magnet cities, where there are LGBTQ people from small towns and rural communities across the region who come to these places to be with other people who identify like them, and to also not necessarily be recognized with the people, right, that they might be at home with, and are having to kind of walk in their daily lives, and maybe facing backlash. But I think that because of that joy and that culture, you know, it also can become a target. You know, I think that one of the things that we've been reflecting on, right, is also the Upstairs Lounge arson attack that happened in 1973 in New Orleans, right?
Yeah.
Where 32 people died. And I think that for our communities, right, that the site of the gay bar, I think that it has also created a very real fear in our communities. And especially during Pride season, right, where we've created and worked so hard to build these spaces up over time where we feel truly free in our gender and sexual expression. And I think that when acts of violence happen in those places, there is a kind of, like, deep breath, collective, like, sigh. Like, what do we do when the places that we have built are right. directly attacked? How do we rise up from the ashes? And what does our continued building of safety and security look like within that?
Yeah. And will there be some kind of discussion? I mean, obviously, we're a huge country right now, but will your organization and others present some kind of agenda to the United States government, even though we're in an election year and we have wildly different ideas about who's to blame here and what's going on? But will you think long and hard about what you demand from our government in order to feel safe again, to keep these kinds of attacks from happening?
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, I think it is a conversation that we are always in, and I think as an organization that doesn't necessarily believe in the punitive nature of so much of the legislation that we create in our country that continues to make criminals out of a lot of folks who fall in our membership, right? So when we talk about what do we demand of the U.S. government, right, there's so many cuts to that, whether we're talking about immigration issues for undocumented trans women, whether we're talking about deportation, whether we're talking about what do we expect from the state when police violence happens to trans and gender nonconforming black folks, right? I think that for us, it doesn't just settle on particular acts and particular incidents that get a lot of coverage, right? I think that it does continue to be a conversation in our communities. I think especially because, you know, the narrative right now and the story that we're told over and over again is that the U.S. is the safest place in the world mm-hmm. for LGBTQ people to be. And I think that we continuously see that that story is actually detrimental to being able to counter the violence that is happening all around us all the time, and that we have to actually understand kind of how culture and rhetoric play into justifying hate crimes, you know. And I think that when these incidents happen, the kind of hate crime conversation, the hate crimes legislation conversation always bubbles up and surfaces up. And I think for our communities who are deeply impacted and targeted by legislation that ends in incarceration, we have to have serious conversations with ourselves about what is the relationship and our collective responsibility to end violence? How do we transform behavior? And what does justice in that context actually look like? Does it look like just sentencing someone and putting them in jail, right? And I think that that conversation is not a simple conversation. It's not a black and white conversation. And our communities don't always agree on that. You know, I think within the LGBT community, you know, when we're talking across race lines and ethnic lines and religious lines and class lines, right, because those are all the different places that the LGBTQ community comes from. It's incredibly diverse. That conversation often creates conflict within community, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that what we're trying to build is a place to have a conversation where we can get to shared values so that we can make, you know, make the U.S. government actually respond in a way that's desired versus just here's a like, very quick solution to plug this gap, right?
Right. Tell me, and I know this is different from person to person, but there probably are a set of real problem areas that those who are in your Hsong community, Southerners on New Ground, who are Muslims, are facing right now. Are there not? That just is a hard road to take.
Yeah, you know, I think that number one, I think that a lot of the conversation that we see happens, number one, just invisibilizes Muslim folks, you know, who have all kinds of racial and ethnic identities who are also LGBT, right? I think that's like the one of the first things that we see. And then I think there's also, I think both within the LGBT community and with outside of it, I think a kind of jump the gun moment where people are like, oh, was that person, you know, Arab or was that person Muslim, you know? And I think depending on kind of how the racial and ethnic identity plays out, right, we see the media conversation move forward to automatically call it an act of terror versus something else, right? And so I think that for LGBT community across race, it's really important for us to talk about the rising Islamophobia that comes out of moments like this, and to talk about how that overlaps and intersects with the homophobia and transphobia that is also coming out in spaces, right? And I think for our community and for folks in our community, it's really important to not dislodge those conversations from each other, right? Because the way that homophobia and transphobia play out is often very racialized and, you know, has different consequences on different people in our communities at different moments in time. And so I think that we've really been having, you know, we're a multiracial organization. We have white folks in our organization, and we have been having the conversation, what does it mean to be a white LGBTQ person in this time, in this country, with such massive racial rhetoric, right, rising up with various politicians and being fueled by folks like Donald Trump? What is the responsibility of white LGBTQ people in this time to have conversations with each other, to not use Islamophobia or other racial rhetoric to blame particular communities for acts of violence that happen to LGBTQ people?
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them momentarily. Irma Linda Cortez is our guest this hour. We're talking about the shooting over the weekend, the worst act of terror in American history, and she is communications director for Hsong. They've been around for over 20 years, Southerners on New Ground. They're known for organizing and training work across issues of race, class, gender, culture, and sexuality with LGBTQ people and allies. We'll take phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls. Irma Linda Cortez is our guest, and let us go to Gary in Merrill, our first caller for you. Hi, Gary.
Yes, good morning or afternoon. I think your guest is confusing Islamophobia with common sense and good judgment. The grand imam of the mosque in Orlando has been calling for the killing of gays for months. And this man, his father, on his website, was always attacking gay people. Every Arab country in the Middle East has laws against homosexuality. So if Hillary and the president, their goal is to bring in millions of Muslims, what does she think the outcome is going to be? Are they going to change their religion because they come to the United States? I don't think so. I think what we've seen here, as terrible as it is, I think it's just the beginning of a turn in our society.
Well, Gary, you must admit that there were a lot of people of other religious faiths who were hardly pro-LGBT.
But we weren't. But people weren't killing them. This is a whole different strategy where the head of a religion, like the Pope, would come out and talk about killing a whole group of people.
Well, you can't say that the head of the Muslim faith is called for killing gay people. There are, of course, terror groups within that faith, as there have been terror groups in other faiths as well. But I'm sorry, let me turn this to you, Emerlinda.
Sure. Yeah, you know, I think that I don't think it's off base to say that Islamophobia arises out of these moments, you know, because I do think that regardless of what particular leaders in faith call for or don't call for, right, in faith across the board, everything from Christianity to Islam, right, we are always dealing with particular individuals who feel fundamental in a call to act out their religious beliefs. In violent ways, right? But I think that there's, throughout the course of American history and global history, countless references we can make that have happened, and that fundamentalism, I think, is what creeps up, right, and that we see enacted out in violence. And I really don't think that we can afford in this country to say, oh, now we're going to, you know, ban all people of X, Y, and Z religion, and in this case specifically is Islam, because suddenly all of these people believe this. I mean, it's just not the case, right? We have to treat people as individually responsible for their actions, and we also have to hold accountable the leaders that are calling people into that, and understand that, like, the rhetoric that comes out, right, isn't from the entirety of a faith. I mean, it's just like, no, when Dylann Roof, you know, was shooting up a South Carolina church, and like deeply Christian white supremacist underpinnings, right? A month and month and month of stuff that was discovered, you know, after the shooting of the Emanuel AME church in Tarleton, whose anniversary is this week. Nobody was calling that, you know, okay, now we need to ban all Christians coming into the United States, right? And I think that there's also a very long history of the violence of Christianity against LGBTQ people, against black people,
right,
you know, against indigenous people.
Yeah. And it must be difficult for people who are of the Muslim faith to deal with this one-stroke definition of all Muslims hate gay people, even though you're a gay Muslim yourself, and so we can't allow any Muslims in because they're going to create, you know, they're going to create terror against gay people in this country. There are people, you know, who are horrible people who are beheading gay people in various places in this country, and I mean in the world. Members of the Islamic State are doing that, but not all Muslims are members of the Islamic State, and you're painting everybody with the same brush, aren't you, if you're saying we just can't have all the, and it must be difficult for Muslims in your organization to be painted with the same brush because they're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and I can only say this as an ally of my Muslim friends, you know, and as somebody who practices a spirituality that, you know, I think that there are diverse views, right, of folks in our community, from every major religion across the world. And I just, like, really, really believe that any person from any faith tradition cannot be necessarily lumped in, right, and saying that this entire spiritual way of thinking and way of being can be attached to one person's actions.
Right. All right, let's go on to Robert in Three Lakes. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
Yes, Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm from Three Lakes.
Uh-huh.
I've got a solution for this gun problem.
Okay.
The government should buy all those guns back from people that own them and put the guns in the military. We can use them in the military. That's the same gun they use in the military. And pay each person $1,000 to buy the gun back, because in 1930s they banned Thompson machine guns. Remember that?
They banned Thompson machine guns?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They bought them all back from people.
Hmm.
This way, there's no money lost. People got rid of these guns. And these guns are absolutely useless for hunting. I'm a hunter up here.
Mm-hmm.
And I have 5-6 guns, too, and every one is for ducks, deer. And these guns are absolutely useless for something like that. All they do is kill people.
Mm-hmm.
That's my solution to the problem.
Thank you, Robert, for your call. Ermelinda, is your organization taking on the issue of guns?
You know, I think that we certainly cannot deny in the U.S. that there have been a mass number of massacres due to gun violence. And I think that for us as an organization, we're really also thinking hard about what causes that, right? Because when we look at the number of transgender and LGBTQ gender nonconforming folks that have been murdered in the U.S. over the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years, it has not been massively due to gun violence, right? But if we're talking about hate crimes around sexual orientation and gender identity, right, that are happening on a case-by-case basis. And I think that when we're talking about that type of crisis of violence, we can't just dilute the conversation to gun control. So as an organization, we're not addressing the ownership of guns or what needs to happen to guns, but we are talking about the overall cultural context that creates the environment that, you know, justifies the violence against different communities, whether they're LGBT communities, Black communities, people of color communities, immigrant communities, or Muslim communities. I think for us, we are really trying to unravel the conversation about what produces that in our society, right? Because whether or not we take away all the guns off the shelves, there are still going to be hate crimes that are committed. And I think it is our collective responsibility in this country to talk about where that comes from and how do we intervene on it.
Thanks, Robert, for your call. Kelly in Darlington, hi.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good, Kelly.
Yeah,
how are you?
Good. I'm a manic bipolar depressant, and I take medication twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
I get through life very well, and I enjoy life. But the thing with me, with this whole thing of blaming Muslims and everything else, it's we're talking a man with a mental illness, just like I have. I've never owned a gun for the fear that I always feared before I was diagnosed, that if I would have had one, I ain't too sure I wouldn't have been able to do just what that man did. And but what my fear is today, and we've got to do something about it, that say if I forget to take my medication or whatever, that I cannot be able to buy a gun. I do not want to be able to buy a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And we have got to get past this Second Amendment crap, is what I call it, and start looking at the whole thing, and that it's common sense. And the NRA is taking money to get people elected. It's not about the Second Amendment. It's about money to get politicians elected.
Thanks, Kelly, very much for your comments. Let's go to Linda in Milwaukee next. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I hope I can reiterate what I'm trying to say. Years ago, I can vividly remember this. It was probably, I don't know how many years ago, I went to a lesbian gay meeting. And a lesbian said to me that I had to pick whether I was lesbian or straight. And I thought about it, and I thought, why? And I knew that I was bisexual, and I thought, why do I have to pick? And so as life progressed, a couple things happened to me, and I would still define myself, if I have to, as bisexual. But the point being is I realized that I was a human being, and I felt very deeply hurt by that particular lesbian woman that told me I had to pick. And as I progressed in life, I ended up experiencing a double murder, and I testified in court. And the point I'm saying to all of this, I'm going to keep it as simple as I can, because I think we're people. And the other day I went to the parade, and I was walking. I was about 12 blocks from the parade. And what bothers me in our society is the idea that we all can be shot accidentally by a bullet. It doesn't matter who we are, what we are, where we are. And after witnessing that double murder, I remembered I hate guns, and I started thinking more deeply on that level. And there's a sense of sadness that I feel that nobody, no human being should be shot accidentally or anything, no matter who, what, wherever. And I feel so passionate about this.
Well, I think most people would agree with you. And the thing about this particular shooting is that it seems, Ermelinda, that this place was targeted. He'd been looking at another, he'd been researching another gay nightclub before he settled on the Pulse nightclub. It was a targeted shooting.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, I feel like we're hearing a lot of about this kind of like all lives matter, or all lives are important. And then this is a tragedy against humanity. And, I think, of course, all lives are important, but I also think that there is a particular cultural response happening right now to the demands of Black people and of Latino people and other communities of color who are saying we are actually in this country no longer going to idly sit by as we are targeted because of our racial identity or our ethnic identity. And targeted with acts of violence, which has been the course of history in this country. And for those of us who are LGBTQ and also share an identity as Black, as immigrant, as Latino, et cetera, you know, that the reality is that, well, yes, all lives might be important, and the odds of acts of violence happening against us increases if we are LGBT, if we are LGBT and Black, if we are LGBT and immigrant, et cetera. And I think that this is a prime example, right, of what happens when a particular community is targeted. And I think that we cannot erode that conversation. I think that it is dangerous for us to not talk about how that happens in our country and how that has happened over the course of time, right? And I think that if we trace the kind of particular acts of violence that have happened in that over the course of time in our country, it had almost always happened as part of a larger cultural moment and backlash against any particular community, right? So we are not thinking about this as an isolated incident. Like, we have to also think about this in the context of a time in the U.S., right, from January till now, what we are often calling the Confederate Spring. Right. And in so many of our southern states, there were bills that were introduced that were specifically targeted at trans and lesbian, gay, bisexual and queer communities. And I think that what we know is that when that rhetoric happens and when it unfolds, right, it becomes easier for people to enact the acts of violence. Right. Because it is then justified. Right. So I think that for us, it's really, really important to talk about and to understand as much as we can that we can't actually separate identity from the conversation of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, the turn of that is, right, when we're talking about how mass acts of violence unfold, right, when we talk about white people who are also unfolding massive acts of violence
that the punishment or the way that the media talks about the conversation is vastly different given the racial or ethnic identity of the person. And I think that for us, we just, it's really difficult, right, as walking through the world and our lives to separate those things.
Mm-hmm. So when the vitriol increases, as it has with all of those bills, the violence increases?
Yes, I think so. You know, I think that, like I said, the daily violence doesn't ever totally cease. You know, I think we're always asking ourselves, what does safety mean? And the reality is that sometimes the safety, you know, the safety that we're trying to define when we're in the HIV crisis versus talking about the number of trans women of color that have been murdered, right? How do we create that safety? And how do we do that in cultural moments that are actually pushing back on our communities, organizing against that violence and against that rhetoric? I mean, the LGBTQ movement as a whole has come light years in the past 50 years, but I think the increased violence that we have seen over the course of 2015 and 2016 is a direct response to that organized resistance of our communities. And so I think that we see that both in policy and we see that in culture.
Emerlinda Cortez is our guest, communications director for SONG, Southerners on New Ground is the name of the organization, and they work on issues of race, class, gender, culture, and sexuality with LGBTQ people and their allies. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We'll take more phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls, and our next caller is Tony in Madison. Hi, Tony.
Hi. As I listen to the conversation, I can't help but think that this is about building community, and that's what we're missing here right now. When 9/11 happened, I had Egyptian friends that found it very hard to live here because of who they were and what they were. I have Latino friends that have issues, and it's really because my community, the white community, doesn't reach out and make sure acceptance is the rule. If we don't build communities, this isn't going to get better. If people can't find commonalities and be comfortable where they're at, they're going to seek out alternatives, and dangerous things can happen, or just being disgusted with a community can happen, or not being a part of the community. But we need everybody to bring everything they have to America, to the communities they live in, and to the neighborhoods they live in, to make sure that everybody gets to grow up and be well and be healthy.
You know, we've been working toward that. We've made some progress, Emerlinda, haven't we?
No, I think that we have, you know, and I think that even in my own life, you know, because I think that we can get stuck on the rhetoric, right? I think as somebody who is LGBT identified, who grew up in an immigrant family in a very rural place and felt like I had to fled that rural place and then 10 years later was able to return to that place, I think that we hear those stories over and over again from folks. And I think that the young people that I talk to today, right, we're a multi-generational organization spanning the ages of 14 to 75. And it is absolutely magical and inspiring to have those people in space together and moving. It's emotionally moving to hear the stories that the folks in their 70s are sharing with us about what they have experienced mm-hmm. in their lives, right, as you know, everything, like one of our founders, Pat Hussein, at our membership gathering this weekend was just kind of going over with folks again, like, you know, the two-piece clothing rule with folks. Some folks will probably know and others might not, but when LGBTQ people would go into bars in the 70s, you know, in order to not be arrested by the police, they were required to have two pieces of clothing on themselves that matched with the gender identity that they were perceived as, right? And I think that being able to hear those stories from our 70-year-old elders and sharing that space with young people who are just like, I go out to the bar every Friday and Saturday night and am able to wear what I want to wear and love on who I want to love on and dance with who I want to dance with and not have fear of consequences, you know, I think that that example shows how much we have come in this country, and that has happened through organizing and through community building. And I think that, you know, that love and the kinship that we build with each other and build with our allies is actually the social
thread and the fabric and the glue that will be able to, I think, the entirety of the U.S. to move into, you know, a 21st century that actually embraces everyone who is in this country. You know, and I think that we have to figure out what does that look like in our policy and culture that unearths violence and difference, right? Not to squash our differences together and to act like they don't exist, but to understand how we build the types of communities and governances where we can actually carry our differences out into community and learn how to disagree. You know, I think that is absolutely crucial to, you know, what I think folks will call the Great American Project. And I think that as a country, if we cannot figure that out, we cannot continue to pretend that it's okay to take that to other places around the world where LGBTQ people are also facing massive violence.
Thanks very much, Toni, for the call. And what about the fear? I've done a lot of reading over the weekend that a lot of people, understandably so, are, as people were afraid after 9/11, people are afraid of congregating in clubs, of being in parades. Okay. There is an element of fear. Do you find that that's true in your organization, or are people just remaining steadfast to principles and going to be out in public places and just conquering fear?
I think it's a combination of both, you know. I think that most of our members have not been lulled into the conversation that now as LGBTQ people we are always safe, because a lot of our folks are Black, a lot of our folks are undocumented, a lot of our folks live in rural communities and small towns, you know, et cetera, and the list goes on. And, you know, like I've mentioned multiple times, the reality is that people are facing, you know, racism and homophobia and transphobia on a daily basis. And so the idea of safety in some ways is a fallacy. And that being said, we find courage and are emboldened by our love and our kinship with one another. And I think that there is a stubbornness in some ways of our community to say, actually, like, we lived in the closet for so many decades and we're not going back. We're not going to do that, you know, and I think that folks have probably seen in communities, you know, from small towns to big urban cities all across this country, people are holding vigils, people are still right. going to Pride, people are having their moment to mourn and to remember those that were taken from us, and people are still going to be dancing with one another, people are still going to be sharing space with one another, and that conversation, of course, cannot be removed from the conversation about how do we actually stay secure in the spaces that we go to, you know, because I think that it is absolutely crucial that we continue to emerge in public space together, and that has actually only been the effort, that the thing that has provided a safety, right, is when we come out together, when we refuse to be closeted, when we refuse to go underground because of who we are, is the closest thing to safety that we can actually mm-hmm. get, you know, and I think that our community is so full of culture and so full of joy, and I don't think that we will lose that, you know. I think we're still going to be twerking in the streets of Pride in various places across this country over the summer, and I think while we're doing that, we will hold in our hearts and our spirits not only the folks that we lost in Orlando, but the long legacy of LGBTQ people that we have lost to violence.
Yeah. Teresa in Stevens Point, hi.
Hi. My heart goes out to everyone that lost loved ones, and my heart goes out to the LGBT community. I'm just calling to clarify and actually argue against a statement that was made a while back when a caller said that, you know, the tragedy was due to Islam having such a negative view of the gay culture, and it was said that, well, no Christians have ever called for gays to be killed, and that's not actually true. There's a pastor in North Carolina, Kevin Swanson, who has actually mm-hmm. called for our government to kill gays, and there were two other pastors in Kansas and Arizona that have echoed his sentiments, and there were actually three Republican presidential candidates that were at Kevin Swanson's rally. So just because there hasn't been any violence created lately by Christians doesn't mean that there's not someone out there with the intent or the capability to do so. And I'd hope that many Christians come together over this, and let's not blame religion on it. Christians have called for killing gay people. And I think although the Pope has called for love and tolerance and embracing LGBT, I hope Christians listen to this and carry that out. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call, Therese. Emmerlinda?
Yeah, you know, I think it's true. I think, you know, that being in the South, which always gets characterized in all kinds of different ways, but often backwards, right, and a place where religion is deeply part of the culture, I think on all political sides, right, that we have, as an organization in the political and cultural work that we do face this regularly, where we are in our towns and our faith where there is political leadership that is deeply backed by a violent rhetoric, right? And sometimes that looks like people calling for acts of violence, and sometimes that calls for acts of shunning, right? And I think that it is absolutely true that, you know, that this spans across religion. It is not just one religion, and I think that has always been the history in this country and around the world, where different religions and the fundamentalism that comes at a particular spectrum of any of these religions has been used to justify violence in all kinds of different communities, right? And I think that for us, when we're engaging in those conversations locally in community, it does happen, where people know, you know, they know where people on certain town councils or board of supervisors, right, they know where they go to church. They know which pastors in the community are the most vitriolic, and they also know which churches are the sanctuaries and which mosques are the sanctuaries. Where can I go and where can I not go? And I think that is a real conversation that we have and have to work through together, because I think otherwise it just really, it puts us into a box, you know, to talk about what this country looks like from the local level to the national level. And how do we hold political leaders responsible in a place where the conversation of religion and government, we sometimes like to talk about it like it's separate, but it is actually inherently connected.
And we have time for one more phone call. It's Patrick in Milwaukee. Hi, Patrick.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Thank you for letting me talk.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to the dialogue develop, better gun laws, but gun laws aren't really, as your guest speaker said, the answer, or diluting it down to that. It is who we look for as leaders of our country to either direct us in the right way or the wrong way, and we're seeing such ugliness being supported by such a large part of our country. You wonder, I'm not saying this has been said, like the media, it's the media's fault of Trump existing. It's just the media's fault for not holding Trump's feet to the fire and answering questions that are not considered, appropriate or civil rights violations. So let's all hope we keep learning, and this terrible thing that happened doesn't ever occur again. But let's hope for the best.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks for the call. A good note on which to end. We thank you, Emmerlinda Cortez, very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
She is communications director for SONG, Southerners on New Ground. Tomorrow, during the first hour of our program, tomorrow is the first ever United States of Women Summit at the White House. The event will celebrate the progress that we've made to advance gender equality here at home and abroad, and also will chart a course for the work that remains. We'll be speaking tomorrow to event organizers and find out how far we've come as a nation regarding gender equality. Hour two of our program. Hold on. The book fell on the floor, so I had to pick it up. It's really a fascinating book, The Virgin Vote, How Young Americans Made Democracy, Social, Politics, Personal, and Voting Popular in the 19th Century. It's a look at how we voted in huge numbers from 1840 to 1900. John Grinspan is a historian of American democracy, youth, and popular culture. He's a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. So that should be interesting. Thanks very much to KP Whaley. and to Carrie Salinas for producing and doing on-air production of today's program. I hope better days are ahead for this country. It's been a hard weekend. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your comments.